Part 3 Chapter 8 Election Day. One day, a letter appeared at Hila's home bearing an impressive blue seal of a type she had never before seen. When Muskanyar arrived, he read the message aloud. Afghanistan's first presidential elections are upcoming. The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan is seeking individuals to work in the forthcoming voter registration drive. Women are encouraged to apply. Hila and Muskanyar stared at each other. It was mid-2004, about a year since her neighbor Jamila had discovered Hila's underground school and forced it to close. Since then, Hila had lost herself within the four walls of her house. It had been a particularly trying few months after her mother-in-law had passed away, for though the old woman had been a thorn in her side, the loneliness was oppressive. Now this opportunity jolted her like news from a long-lost friend. So she and Muskanyar began to plot. This time, they would have to be doubly careful. Jamila's words, "Keep going on like this and no one will see a family member of yours alive," still rang in her ears. To pull this off, Hila knew she'd have to work somewhere far from the village. As the only educated woman in huge swaths of Khasuruzgan, Hila had no trouble landing the job. Muskanyar was enlisted as well, and since Hila could not be trained directly, he was coached and passed along what he learned. One evening, he came home with a stack of voter registration cards that they were to distribute to poor villagers across the district. Most of the villagers had never voted for anything in their lives, but an unending stream of radio news and public service announcements had everyone thinking about the elections. People had started speaking knowingly about politics, the way they spoke about the coming rains or the year's crops. It was warm outside on their first day of work, and Hila was up earlier than usual. Climbing into the back of the station wagon, she waited until Muskanyar appeared, dressed as usual in a crisp white salwar. They set out before the sky dawn to avoid the neighbors. After an hour of driving on a broken gravel road that wound through the dusty mountain country, they reached the far side of the district, home to a different clan, where their family was not known. Hila sat in the car and watched Muskanyar speak to the Malik, the village headman. After some time, he gathered all the menfolk in front of the mosque. They thronged around her husband, kissing his hand, and she could hear them pleading for better roads and clinics. For these villagers, who had never met a representative of the government or the United Nations before, it was as if he were an emissary from President Karzai himself. As dozens of curious faces looked on, Muskanyar explained that his only job was to register them to vote. He described the registration process, which required each person to fill out a card. Since few could read or write, he ended up completing most of the cards himself. And because most lacked proper identification, he created makeshift IDs with the Polaroid camera he'd brought along. After the crowd dispersed, Muskanyar walked the Malik out of earshot. They spoke and then turned and looked at Hila in the car and continued the conversation. Eventually, Muskanyar shook the Malik's hands and hugged him, and he returned to the vehicle alone. Women getting caught up in politics, the Malik had told him, would be like men going into the kitchen. Like men raising babies and women fighting war. There would be no female registration here. They drove on to other villages, and in each the result was the same. Back home, Hila and Muskanyar put their heads together. She wasn't ready to give up. It was Muskanyar who first struck up the ruse. Medicines. The next day, as he discussed voting with the men of another village, Hila was escorted from house to hand out cheap medications from their pharmacy. Once inside, alone among the women, Hila delivered her speech on democracy and voting. She filled out cards for them and explained that, unlike for the men, a photograph wasn't required. Some women, fearing their husbands, refused to accept a card. Others clutched them as if they were precious gifts. In some houses, she met women who knew a thing or two about Kabul from the radio, and she spoke at length with them about the candidates. Although she wasn't supposed to favor one contender, she couldn't imagine anyone but Karzai for the job, and she never met anyone who disagreed. She explained that a woman's vote was hers alone, not her husband's. Some housewives scoffed and said that it was wrong to divide a man and woman in this way, but others nodded in agreement. During those weeks, Hilah wondered for the first time if she might have a future in politics. Working for a candidate, perhaps, or continuing on with the United Nations if they'd allow her. To be out in the world, teaching, connecting. She felt that tug again, that force inside her that had led her to risk so much already. At home, she pored over the Constitution and studied up on the candidates' profiles, then lectured the women on what she'd learned. If only she could convince them that they too belonged to the public world. Those small flashes of confidence she sometimes noticed in their eyes might grow into something of meaning and value, just as they had for her. Still, she had moments of doubt. In one hillside village, she gave a card to a woman married to an Afghan who was living in Pakistan. "Sometimes a village is so small," Hila recalled, "that when someone gets a card, everyone knows, and so even her husband in Pakistan heard about it. People started talking. So-and-so's wife received a card. She must be going out of the house on her own. She is getting involved in men's affairs. Maybe she has taken a lover, and so on. It was a big shame for her husband." When two of the woman's relatives escorted her back to Pakistan, they found her husband livid. A shouting match erupted between him and the relatives, whom he held responsible for his wife's indiscretions. Physical threats followed, until the husband pulled out a pistol and shot them, killing one and leaving the other critically wounded. "This was all from a card I gave," Hila said. But for every story like this, there were others that filled her with hope. Women tearfully promising to vote, girls asking about life in Kabul, and even in a few cases, husbands encouraging their wives to register. "The registration cards were like little bricks," she said. "We wanted to build Afghanistan." The election, scheduled for October 2004, was to be the showpiece of Western efforts over the previous 3 years. The candidates included Gelam Jam leader Rashid Dostum, warlord Mohammed Mohakeik, who had commanded Hazara militias during the Civil War, and 21 other figures from around the country. But in Hila's estimation, Hamid Karzai, a fellow southern Pashtun, was the runaway favorite. Muskanyar agreed, and he could not find a soul who would speak ill of the interim president. Karzai had, after all, launched his uprising against the Taliban right there in Uruzgan, and the economy had blossomed since the Americans arrived. The summer came and registration slowed, as the men were busy in the orchards and the women with their dried fruits. The fields abutting Hila's house had grown tall with the season, and it was in those fields that a boy from her village wandered one day, following the labyrinth of donkey trails that connected one plot to the next. He stepped through reeds up to his eyes and waded across tiny streams, and then he stopped cold. Lying in front of him, face down, was a body. There was a single bullet wound to the back of the head. The dead man was not from the village. No one could quite say where he had come from. There had been sporadic killings elsewhere in the district, but something like this had not happened here in the village since the Civil War. The body was buried in an unmarked grave. For days, it was all anyone could talk about. A week later, a man working for an NGO in a neighboring district went missing. Muskanyar had known him well, having served him often at the pharmacy. Shortly after, the UN issued a warning to employees. The security situation was worsening as the elections neared, although no one in Hila's village could figure out whom to hold responsible. As the mood shifted, men in the bazaar began speaking vaguely about the situation. Muskanyar concluded that it was just too dangerous for a woman to be moving about in far-flung villages. At first he said nothing, but Hila knew what he was thinking. When he finally told her, some days later, that it's better for you to stay home from now on, she was unsurprised. And she knew that her husband could be a stubborn man, that once he made up his mind, even the prophet himself could not change it. But she tried anyway. She had been preparing a defense for just such an eventuality, and over dinner and the next morning, she laid out her case. Without her, Khasuruzgan's women would be cut off, effectively disenfranchised. If they gave up at first sight of instability, how could they expect to accomplish anything? And the money? They were now earning more together than ever before. He listened quietly, but refused to budge.
"If anything were to happen to you," he said, "I would not be able to live with myself."
One summer afternoon, a year earlier, Quduz Khan, the governor of Khasruzgan, had been sitting in his office speaking to village elders when the district chief of police, Muhammad, pulled up in front of the building. He greeted the security guards out front, then strode briskly through the corridors and into the governor's office. He aimed his Kalashnikov at the governor. The men looked up. Muhammad squeezed the trigger. The governor's body jerked backward, and he fired again. The elders sat staring at the bloody mess. Muhammad turned, walked out, and drove off in his Ford Ranger police truck, lights flashing. He phoned officials in Tirinkot to boast about his exploit, then continued on to another district and disappeared. It was then that the killings had started to become a regular occurrence, and bodies began turning up around the district. But the genesis of the bloodshed could be traced to much earlier. After U.S. forces assaulted the school and the governor's house in January 2002, wiping out most of the district's pro-U.S. leadership in a single night, local politics were changed forever. The tenuously balanced forces that had ruled the district for a decade were swiftly replaced by one man, John Muhammad. Shortly after the killings, he had appointed his ally, Quduz Khan, as district governor. The scion of an elite family, Quduz Khan owned ample tracts of land and commanded the allegiance of thousands from his tribe, the Alizai. Having survived the civil war with relatively clean hands, he enjoyed popular support, and under his reign, Khasruzgan remained largely at peace. He worked closely with U.S. forces, landing lucrative contracts for reconstruction and security. Such success did not go unnoticed in Tirinkot, and JMK began to fear that his gilded position atop the province's patronage pyramid was in jeopardy, that his own appointee was perhaps too popular. It so happened that Quduz Khan's tribe was locked in a decades-long rivalry with the Karimzai tribe, so JMK replaced Malik Rauf as Khasruzgan's chief of police with a Karimzai named Asadullah. Jealousy and mistrust followed, and each man jockeyed for influence and access to the Americans. Unsurprisingly, this did not end well. In the summer of 2003, police chief Asadullah was mysteriously gunned down as he drove to meet friends for dinner. The attack, the first political killing in the district since the American massacre, shook the authorities. But they chose not to conduct an investigation, and soon the bazaar was bubbling with speculation that Quduz Khan was the culprit. JMK, keeping with his divide-and-conquer approach, then appointed Asadullah's grieving brother Muhammad as the new police chief for Khasruzgan. Muhammad wasted little time in securing his revenge. Years later, he too would be mysteriously shot to death. Upon Quduz Khan's death, tribal leadership passed to his son, Nakibullah, who had also inherited a bit of his father's sense of stature. Suspecting that JMK was behind the whole affair, he denounced the governor publicly, a reckless move in John Muhammad's Uruzgan if there ever was one. Nakibullah was promptly arrested by the Americans as a Taliban agent and shipped off to Bagram. JMK then appointed a close ally, Haji Obaidullah, to the governorship. For police chief, he chose Commander Zahir, the son of erstwhile police chief Malik Rauf. Unlike his father, whose affable ways had won him community support, Zahir proved notoriously ill-tempered and combative. He was built like a cauldron, with an enormous wedge of a nose to fit his bulbous face, and wherever he showed up, trouble usually followed. The district's once effective police force became an open bazaar. Drug traffickers bribed policemen, officers auctioned extra weapons on the black market, and criminals paid their way to freedom. Under the guise of security, Zahir established checkpoints and forcibly extracted a tax from motorists. For the first time since the Civil War years, people felt insecure. In one area, residents formed a pro-government militia for protection, but Zahir, viewing them as competition, informed the Americans that they were Taliban, and U.S. forces killed them all. The venality felt like a sickness, as Hila put it. Finally, local elders convened a meeting of tribal elders and educated people to address the ballooning sense of discontent. Muskinyar sat quietly through the discussion, listening as the greybeards considered how best to convince Tirin Khat to remove Zahir. He was not the type to speak up in meetings. In fact, he hated crowds of any sort. But he found the conversation excruciating. "You're all avoiding the issue," he finally said. "We can't change anything around here so long as John Muhammad is running things." The room went cold silent. As he proceeded to describe what everyone knew, the men stared into their laps or thumbed their prayer beads. When he finished, the elders continued to sit wordlessly until one of them finally spoke and changed the subject. Afterward, people whispered that it was a brave thing he had done. But there wasn't much more to be said, for JMK had informers everywhere. Everyone knew what had happened to Naqibullah, and he was from an illustrious family, no less. Still, it seemed that the entire village had heard of Muskinyar's remarks. Gossip reached the bazaar and government offices, and soon enough hit the ears of Zahir himself. He said nothing and did nothing, but everyone knew that he had a long memory for such things. Hila arose early, long before sunrise, on the morning of October 9, 2004. Outside, under an indigo sky, she could make out the silhouettes of several hulking men in the front yard. They wore large turbans and had rifles slung over their shoulders. "Our security for today," Muskinyar said. It was the day of the first presidential election in her country's history. Muskinyar had done so well during the registration drive that he had been hired to oversee election day for the entire district. It had meant late nights for weeks, traveling with U.S. forces to help survey potential polling sites, hiring and training local staff, coordinating ballot distribution, sometimes using donkeys, and arranging for the results to be safely and accurately counted. Now the UN also needed a woman to manage the sole female polling station, and Muskinyar allowed Hila to work on the condition that she was provided security. By sunrise they arrived at the polling center, the main schoolhouse. A curtain down the middle of the compound separated the male and female voters. As Hila proceeded to her section, she could see a crowd of men gathering near the gate a good hour before polls opened. She helped erect the booths and gather the documents, and then the gates opened and people rushed in. Khasur Uzgan's sunburned farmers flashed toothy smiles and waved to UN photographers as they presented their registration cards and dipped a finger in purple ink to prevent multiple voting. On Hila's side, however, the story was starkly different. "I didn't see a single woman vote," Hila said. "I was the first and last woman to cast a ballot that day." At one point, men arrived with sackloads of registration cards. "They told me, the women in our village don't know anything about politics, so they asked us to vote for them." Still, by day's end, initial results from around the district were already coming in, and the polls were proving to be a resounding success, with a turnout that even Muskinyar hadn't expected. There were boxes from villages so far flung that he had never heard of them. For a country just a few years removed from civil war and brutal dictatorship, the election seemed a watershed. As election workers hugged and congratulated each other, Muskinyar stood by, watching quietly, his eyes brimming. Even Hila took heart. Changing villagers' attitudes might take years, even generations, but she knew that their team had planted the first thoughts of equality in people's minds. Karzai would go on to a landslide victory, the first popular mandate of any ruler in Afghan history. That autumn, Muskinyar found himself thinking often about the future, about staying on with the UN, working the following year's parliamentary elections, about his children in Kabul and the possibility of returning when the time was right, when they'd be ready for university. Omaid, his oldest, wanted to be a doctor when he grew up. He was coming into the pharmacy daily as a sort of apprenticeship, and for Muskinyar the company was a blessing. It was a quiet day at the shop one Saturday afternoon when a customer stopped by and conversation turned to the elections. "I don't think they were a good idea," the man stated. "Why?" Muskinyar asked. "They're expensive. Who can pay these days?" Muskinyar did not understand.
They charge you money for not voting. But it wasn't even my fault. I was traveling, the man said. Muskinyar still did not understand and probed further. Slowly the truth came out. Police officers were going from village to village, announcing via loudspeaker that whoever hadn't voted had to pay a fine. Muskinyar could not believe it. He visited other shops, and everywhere the story was the same. You had to prove you'd voted or cough up the fine, and an ink-stained finger did not suffice. Only a punched voter registration card would do, a step some polling centers had neglected. For all his diffidence, Muskinyar did not conceal anger well. He strode over to the compound of Haji Obeidullah, the district governor, stormed past his secretary, marched through the antechamber with its waiting supplicants, and barged right into the governor's office. "You need to do something about these police! They're out of control!" he shouted. The men seated around the room stared at him, astonished. There were stacks of registration cards on the floor, and a few farmers waiting in a corner. A police officer had a hole punch in his hands. Muskinyar had caught them red-handed.
"How does this concern you?" Governor Obeidullah snapped. "We weren't bothering you in your election work."
The two broke into a shouting match. A second official joined the fray. The farmers, there to surrender their fine, looked on, perplexed and fearful. Men from the hallway came to check on the commotion. The two sides were near blows when finally Muskinyar said,
"If you don't stop this, I'll go to the UN. I'll go straight to Kabul."
Governor Obeidullah shrank back.
"Look, you're making a big deal out of this. Don't worry, we'll take care of it."
He waved his hand.
"It's just a misunderstanding."
Muskinyar stormed out. As he left, he noticed a man sitting in the corner watching him. It was Police Chief Zahir. When Hila heard about the fracas, she was beside herself.
"Do you know what they do to people who cause problems?"
It was true, and Muskinyar couldn't deny it. As soon as he'd reached his car, he had realized his mistake. But it could not be undone. Or could it? Hila begged him to go and apologize, but he thought it would seem cowardly, unmanly. No, he would let the matter rest, without reporting anything to the UN. It would all go away. The next morning, a friend who worked in the police department came by the pharmacy to see Muskinyar.
"Zahir's been asking about you," he said quietly. "You need to be careful."
That evening, Captain Andy Brosnan, head of the American forces stationed nearby, invited a number of officials, as well as Muskinyar, to dinner at the base. Zahir was there, and Muskinyar could feel his eyes on him the entire night. When Brosnan asked Muskinyar about his plans for the coming week, Muskinyar replied directly in English, so that no one else could understand. Zahir chewed silently and watched. After dinner, Muskinyar climbed into his old white Corolla and headed for home. The wind was strong outside, the sky already dark. As he pulled away from the bazaar, there was not a light anywhere for miles. No cars either. He pulled onto the shoulder near the turnoff to his village and sat thinking. He couldn't get Zahir's stare out of his mind. Suddenly, he turned his car around and headed back toward the pharmacy. Better to play things safe, he told himself. He slept that night in the pharmacy. Early the next morning, he headed out over the crater dirt road running toward the village. Nearing a culvert, he spotted a white station wagon, almost identical to his, sitting by the roadside. He pulled up to take a look. The car had been shot up like a sieve, its windshield spiderwebbed. Inside, lying in their own blood, were three bullet-ridden bodies. He glanced around, not a soul in sight. He jumped back in his car and sped home.
"That was meant for you,"
Hila said. Muskinyar didn't say anything. Finally, he told her to ignore it, that it was just a coincidence. Trying to put it out of her mind, she went into the kitchen to chop vegetables for dinner. Busying her hands, giving herself a task, had always put her at ease. It was then that the realization struck her. After Muskinyar had denounced JMK at that meeting of tribal elders, he had mentioned to her that Zabit had been present, the same Zabit who had spread rumors that Hila was running a prostitution center.
Could he have informed Zahir of Muskanyar's comments? He was also linked to a group of Afghans who had a long-running dispute with the family over land. A constellation of thoughts lit up as she jumped from one possible enemy to the next. Again, Jamila's warnings echoed in her head.
No one will see a single family member of yours alive.
She went back to her husband and stood in front of him.
We have to get out of here.
Muskanyar demurred, insisting the car shooting was a tragic fluke. Hila burst into tears.
What if something happened to you? What would I do? I couldn't live.
They ate dinner in silence. Then Hila grabbed him once again and pleaded that he flee now, even if she and the boys couldn't. Muskanyar threw up his hands.
Leave? You want me to leave? You want me to catch a flight out? Is that what you'd like? Fly to Kabul? Are you crazy? How can I leave? There's no airport here. There's nothing.
Then drive.
You want me to drive away, after what I saw on that road?
That evening, a neighbor knocked on the door. For years, Muskanyar had parked his station wagon on the neighbor's side of the river that ran through the village, since there was no room on his side. Now the neighbor politely asked him to remove the car. The ground shook. Hila was standing in the front yard, tending to her apple tree, when she heard a roar. It was nighttime, but she could see a faint white light from the southwest, the direction of Mecca. It grew brighter, and then a second explosion rocked the whole landscape. A yawning chasm opened in the earth, and from it emerged swarms of men running toward her. Now she stood alone in the desert. She ran desperately fast, but the men were gaining ground. They drew so close that she could hear their panting. She turned.
There were armed people coming from all directions, she said. Some of them had American uniforms. Some of them had a terrible scowl. One of them was so thin he had no flesh on his cheeks. His face was just a skull. I screamed and screamed to dear God, looking for my husband. I couldn't find him. One of the men reached out and grabbed me. She snapped awake, panting, lying in her own sweat. Next to her, Muskanyar lay fast asleep. She muttered a kalima, an Islamic prayer. Her thoughts returned to those three unfortunate people murdered by the roadside. The Taliban had officially been denounced as the perpetrators, but she knew that wasn't the case. She headed for the front yard. Looking to the horizon, she traced the outlines of the dark mountains that stretched far in both directions. She hated them. They were a reminder of the unconquerable distance to Kabul, of the unforgettable fact that this would never be home. It was now 3 days since Muskanyar's outburst, and she knew that she'd have to do something. In the moonlight, she started filling empty wheat sacks with sand and soil and stones, lining them up against the windows. Then she piled one sack atop another in the front yard, the beginnings of a bunker. I won't let anyone touch my family, she told herself. I won't. I won't. In the morning, Muskanyar laughed off her paranoia. He wasn't just any old farmer, he reminded her. He was a paid employee of the United Nations, a friend of the Americans, always welcome at their base, an all-around well-regarded member of the community. You have too much imagination, he said. He took the children to school, and Hila decided to busy herself with housework. Muskanyar returned at sunset. As the family seated themselves around a dinner of broiled lamb and rice, there was a knock on the door. It was his uncle. Someone had stolen a gun from his house, and he asked Muskanyar to come investigate. Hila asked him not to go, but he promised he would return soon. Now, alone with the children, Hila cleared the dishes and put the boys to bed. It was about 8, and the sun had slipped behind the mountains. She set about lighting candles and the oil lamp, then went to check on their new dog, leashed in the front yard. A little past 9. Hila was reading by candlelight when the dog started barking. She had forgotten to feed the poor thing. She stepped outside and tossed it some bread and set aside a bowl of water. 10 o'clock. The dog was barking again. Muskanyar had still not returned. Running low on oil, she snuffed out the lamp and the candles, letting the darkness settle.
Her eyes adjusted, and she used the moonlight to make her way around. The barking was incessant. Was the leash too tight? She would have to let the dog run loose. She pushed the door open and went for the animal, then stopped. Something was moving in the front yard. Next to her, the dog stood with its back roached, staring into the darkness. She scanned the yard. The gate was a good 20 paces away. To her right sat the small standalone guest room. To her left, the tiny thicket of apple trees. Something dark and amorphous appeared to be lurking near the guest room. It moved again. Somebody's out there, she thought. She backed into the house. She had no phone, no way of leaving. The children were asleep. Muskanyar kept his automatic rifle in the bedroom. The thought seemed crazy, but she was desperate. When she found it, the weight surprised her. She had never handled a weapon before. She came to the living room, where an open window offered a view of the yard. The dog continued to bark. At first, she could see nothing. Then a shape, a silhouette, emerged from the guest room. There was no mistaking it. Then she noticed another figure crouching under an apple tree, and a third near the wall. And another? She picked out 4 shapes, right in her yard. One of them started walking toward the house. The dog whimpered. Now all the shadows were moving. One passed directly by her window. He wore a large black turban, and his face was covered. His eyes shone under the moonlight. The shadows drew closer. Another one passed the window. Then a third. The fourth, the one crouching by the apple tree, suddenly stood up and walked toward the house. Hila gripped the trigger. The shadow turned and paced back in the direction of the front gate. She placed the gun on the windowsill and aimed. The frame rattled beneath her hands. The figure turned and stared and headed back toward the house again, straight toward her window. She squeezed her eyes shut and pulled the trigger. Village life is normally draped in silence. There are no cars, no generators, no televisions, no pedestrians. The shot rang through the valley and shook the whole house. Cakes of dirt from Hila's mud ceiling fell to the floor. The children came running from their rooms, and somewhere in all of this commotion, Hila heard the sound of footsteps fleeing. When she peered into the yard, the men were gone. Muskanyar returned home around 2 in the morning to find Hila ashen-faced. Scouring the front yard by flashlight, he found footprints and cigarette butts everywhere. He looked shaken. Hila implored him to leave that very night. He seemed lost in thought for a while, then agreed, but he needed time. "Give me 2 days to figure this out," he said. "We'll find a way to Kabul." In the morning, Muskanyar loaded the boys into his Corolla and drove to work. Alone again, Hila threw herself into housework. She couldn't bring herself to look at the front yard, however, not even in daylight. Before noon, a group of women arrived at the house seeking medical attention. Their marem waited in the yard while the women, with a gaggle of coughing, sneezing children, pressed inside. As Hila examined them, one of the women struck up a conversation. They were, it turned out, Commander Zahir's wives. Hila looked up, struggling to control herself. "How are things?" she asked timidly. "How is your family?" "We're all fine, thanks," the woman replied. "But you know how things are in the village these days, with security. It's getting worse." "I heard that a car full of people was attacked yesterday," Hila said. The woman clucked. "The situation is very bad." She leaned forward and stared a long moment at Hila. "Why are you and your family still here? You're such good people. Why don't you leave until things get settled?" "Why?" Hila nearly whispered. "Do you think we might have problems?" Another wife interjected. "We just think it'd be better for you and your husband to spend some time away. That's all." Then the oldest, Zahir's first wife, clasped Hila's wrist with her bony hand and said, "Our husband beats us. He is a cruel and angry man." When Muskanyar arrived that evening, he brought news of his own. His friend in the police force had told him about a rumor that Zahir and John Muhammad had drawn up a list of troublemakers that included some good people. It was all he would say. There was no getting around it. Muskanyar now knew that they would have to find a way out of Khasuruzgan immediately. There were three routes from the district. The roads west and north passed through police checkpoints, which meant that the eastern road, through Hazara territory, might be the only option. First, though, he had to contact friends in Kabul who could take them in. He would need a satellite phone, so he'd have to lean on friends in the UN or the Americans. He would have to work on it. The next morning, October 21st, was the sixth day of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan, and the fifth since Muskanyar had confronted the governor. Hila had been up since 2 a.m, as she had been every day that week, because women prepared the pre-dawn meals. Muskanyar appeared in a pressed salwar and plaid black vest, and the family sat down for breakfast. They ate in silence. The muezzin called, and he rose and gathered his belongings for the pharmacy. "You aren't going to work, are you?" she asked. He stared back as if to say, "Where else would I be going?" "You can't go out there!" She nearly screamed the words. Not in 12 years had she spoken so loudly. Muskanyar ignored her and moved toward the door. Hila stared in disbelief. Stubbornness was one thing. This was too much.
"No!"
she yelled. She threw herself in front of the door.
"You have children! You have a son! He's almost 11!"
She was now in tears.
"What will happen to him?"
Muskanyar grabbed his firearm theatrically and stuck it to his temple.
"Do you want me to sit in the house all day like a woman?"
he shouted back.
"I have a family to support. If I can't do that, what kind of man am I?"
He calmed himself.
"Look, I need to find a satellite phone so we can get to Kabul."
He swore that as soon as he could arrange everything, they would escape. But it might take a few more days, and until then, they needed all the money he could garner. After driving the children to school, he headed to the UN office. They did not, however, have a satellite phone for him to use. He then asked if they could at least assign him bodyguards, but they said that with the elections over, he was no longer their employee or their responsibility. Meanwhile, Hila unclipped his clothes from the drying line. After months of effort, Muskanyar had managed to read the entire Quran, muddling through the archaic Arabic with an accompanying modern Farsi translation. "I want to wear fresh clothes tonight to celebrate," he had told her, "and cologne." Muskanyar had also asked her to make halwa, a sweet carrot dish, in honor of the first anniversary of his mother's death. Families would distribute sweets to the poor as a way of blessing the departed soul. When she finished, she stepped into the backyard to tend to the garden. She was still avoiding the front yard. She kept herself busy until the sun started to slide behind the peaks. It was nearing iftar, the ritual breaking of the day-long fast. A chilled wind gusted across the house, and she wondered if winter might be coming early this year. Lounging in the garden, she listened for the sound of Muskanyar's tires crunching the gravel of the village road. He had mentioned that he might bring his brother Shesta to dinner to discuss the plans to flee. Hila had always disliked Shesta, though she could never put her finger on why. She was hoping instead for a meal alone with her husband and children. After 12 hours of fasting, Muskanyar was eager to get home. Earlier than usual, he locked up the shop and pulled the iron shutter closed. He was with Umayd and Jamshed, and they proceeded to the mosque to offer prayers before iftar. There Muskanyar ran into Shesta and invited him along for dinner, and then the four set out in the Corolla down the village's gravel road. Muskanyar parked the vehicle in a clearing not far from the house. After stopping at a small bakery to pick up some steaming naan for dinner, they made their way along a donkey path until they reached an opening in the trees. Ahead lay the footbridge home. Just then, one of the children pointed to some bushes.
"Father," he asked, "who are they?"
There in the shadows were three men none of them knew. Dinner time neared. A gray overcast dusk rolled out over the land, and Hila retrieved a shawl to keep herself warm. Suddenly, A series of gunshots rang out.
From the moment I heard those bullets, she recalled, it felt like they were hitting my heart.
She raced to the front yard. An icy wind rushed in from the direction of the stream, carrying with it the unmistakable scent of discharging firearms. She thrust her head out the main gate, but saw nothing. Then she scrambled up a ladder resting on the side of the house and balanced herself on the roof. Standing on tiptoes, she could just see across the stream, a good 100 yards away. At first, the landscape looked blissfully empty, nothing but acacias and fruit trees and farmland stretching for miles. And then she saw it. Just barely visible around a bend, near the ravine, was the glint of Muscagnard's white car. She flew down the ladder. "This can't be happening to me," she said to herself. "What sins have I committed?" Cracking the front gate open, she waited for a passing villager. Nothing. She retrieved a headscarf and wrapped it around her head, and in a moment of despair, darted out into the open. For the first time in 10 years in Uruzgan, she had left her house without permission, without her face protected. She felt naked. She ran toward the stream just as a couple of elderly women were coming from the opposite direction.
"Stop, daughter! There are men there! You can't go! I don't care!" she sobbed.
The two women tackled her and kept her back.
"Are you crazy? They'll kill you for wandering out there! Get back in your house! We'll let you know what happened later."
"No,"
she cried, trying to pull free. But she knew they were right. She crumpled to the ground, wailing.
"Just tell me, are they gone? All of them? Is my family gone?"
"No, daughter, everyone is fine," one said, caressing Hila's head. "Everyone is fine."